Welcome to the Best Ever You Network, celebrating our third year on Blog Talk Radio and iTunes. Thank you for helping us become a number one rated live show with over 1 million global listeners. Our team is on a mission to help you discover your authentic best self and bring it to the world. And now, here's our show.
Hi, everybody, and thanks for joining us. I'm Elizabeth Hamilton Guarino, the host of the Best Ever You Show and the founder of the Best Ever You Network at besteveryou.com. I also recently became a Hay House author, and my new book is out. It's called Percolate, Let Your Best Self Filter Through, and it's available wherever books are sold. So talk about your authentic best self. My authentic best self is a little actually hoarse today from being at an event last night in Boston for the Expect Miracles Foundation. It's financial services against cancer, and I posted a blog about it on LinkedIn and Facebook and even Tumblr, and there were about 300 or more financial industry people gathered to raise money for cancer research, and so far Expect Miracles, but I think by the end of the year they will have raised $12 million for cancer research. So kudos to them. Thank you so much for inviting me and my husband Peter to your event. We thoroughly enjoyed the evening and met a lot of great people, so thank you for that. And then real quick, before we bring Corey on, we've got a great guest here today, Corey Poirier. I get to mess with his last name a little bit. He gave me permission. He's got a comedic side to him, so I can mess with him for the full hour with that last name. It's kind of like Guarino. People never get that right. But anyway, our show is also sponsored by Safeair. You can go to safeairmaine.com, where your indoor air quality matters and everything to help you be your best. They're great at helping with mold removal and things like that. So we love Safeair Maine and all that they do to help sponsor our show. So, Corey Poirier, I love it. How are you? I could even rhyme it, like, how are you today? No, I won't.
feel free if you want to. I am doing world-class plus fantastic.
Awesome. I'm gonna spell your last name for people so they can get to your website. I'm going to spell both. It's Corey is Corey, and then the last name is Poirier, and then add a .com to that. Or on Twitter, he is That Speaker Guy. And he's here today because he's so inspirational, so motivational, and so educational. You can hear my voices going, oh, no, I don't want that. He's a professional keynote speaker and an entrepreneur, and he does all sorts of corporate customer service and sales training for people. I love his TEDx. How many TEDx videos do you have? A couple?
Or? Oh, I just have the one.
Oh, you have the one. Okay, that is so cool. He's got a cool TEDx video on his website that you can watch about the five weeds we must pull from our life. Is that what it is?
That's absolutely correct, yeah.
I love it. Great. So tell us more about yourself, and you can just talk and I'll be quiet. How's that sound?
that sounds perfect, but ironically, awesome. Elizabeth, last night I actually was presenting for 3 hours, last night in the evening, so I'm at the start of the same page. But at the same time, it's what I do for a living, so if my voice goes out, there's something wrong. I need to do more vocal lessons. My background, I guess the quickest, easiest version is, because there's a lot to it, is I was raised by a single mother, and that's the only part I'll kind of add in, I guess, that's more on the kind of upbringing side. But why it's so significant to me is because I really feel that who I became and who I am today is really, really, really rooted in being raised by my single mother. So it's a big part of who I am. And so that was kind of the starting point for me. And my mother will openly tell you that the reason I'm a speaker is because she taught me how to talk. She loves to talk. And I essentially, for me, how I got into the world that I'm in today, which is the speaking, sort of the backstory is that I started, which is the weirdest road possible, as many speakers as I've shared the bill with, I've yet to find one that started in the same place that I have. Not to say that there aren't many, but I haven't run into any yet, is I started in the world of stand-up comedy in 2002. I had a friend say, do you want to try a stand-up comedy workshop, 2 weeks at a university? And all we were taught at that course was, here's how you adjust the mic stand, and here's a guy who was running the course, his favorite comic, Steve Martin, rules. That was what we were taught. And then the third week we went to a club, we were told people are going to entertain us, and we found out 5 minutes of showtime that we were actually the entertainers, and with no, you know, literally zero material, zero prep time. And so it was, you know, do or die. Me and 15 would-be stand-up comics were in the room. I went to the bathroom to look for the exit window, which didn't exist.
Yeah.
And when I got back out, 7 of those comics are gone. I've never seen them again. Of the 8 that stayed, 6 perform full-time. That's their whole life. Me and one other person do it sporadically. But I performed like nine years of shows, 700 shows. So it's not like I performed only 2 or 3 shows. And so I started stand-up comedy in 2002, Elizabeth. And then what happened was I realized that I like certain aspects of it, and I like how it honed my skills in terms of as a presenter. But there were parts I didn't like about it. And the part I didn't like the most, well, 2 parts. One was that the comedy community, I was lucky I had a strong community, but when I went to larger cities, it was, you know, the comics, it was more of like a me against the world, because if your show does well, then the other comics maybe doesn't look as good, or if yours does poorly, then theirs looks better. So I didn't like that side of it, and because I'm a collaborator. And the other side I didn't like is that there's times, that's not to say it's all the time, there's times when the audience is rooting against you rather than for you. And I thought, surely there must be a speaking field or a world where, you know, everybody's rooting for you to succeed, and if you don't, they actually would feel more awkward than happy. And so I stumbled onto this thing called the speaking industry, and I didn't know that there was such thing as making a living at it. I just knew that it sounded fun. The only person I knew that was doing it that actually was making a living at the time was Tony Robbins, and I didn't realize that Tony was a speaker. I thought he was a coach, a life coach. So at the end of the day, that's kind of how my exposure to it was, that I started in the stand-up world and realized there were parts I didn't like, but that I did like a lot of it, and I just needed to find something that was closely related. And so basically I performed those stand-up shows for a while, and eventually I started doing free Rotary talks and free talks for groups and nonprofits, and it just kind of kept evolving from there. And that's sort of how I got into the speaking world, which has kind of evolved into everything else I'm also doing right now as well.
For somebody out there who dreams of speaking for a living, and it seems like there are a lot of people who do that. I'm even like that every once in a while. It's like, you know, that'd be so much fun again to be back doing that. Just every once in a while, you know, do a little speech at a corporation or something like that. But for people who have had no introduction to that at all and aspire to do that, can we back up a little bit and help people, because you just said something really key, and that's you started somewhere. You started doing a little talk at a Rotary or a speaking club or something like that. It wasn't like you went out and spoke the first time and somebody gave you a $20,000 paycheck, correct?
Correct, absolutely. Yeah, so okay. Did you want me to kind of go back and sort of reveal what I would recommend as a starting point and maybe a little bit of what I took as a starting point?
I think that would be fantastic, for like a takeaway from this show for somebody who wants to be you. Yeah, I think it'd be great.
Well, perfect. Well, I'll give you, like I said, I separated those two, saying, you know, what I did and what I recommend, because not always identical, if you will. I guess what I would first of all recommend to somebody, I will say, you know, Elizabeth, I'm a big believer in full disclosure, and, you know, I'm glad that people told me this when I started. The speaking industry, so public speaking, is the number one fear in the world, above death. And so what that means, as Jerry Seinfeld has been fond of saying, is that if you're at a funeral, you'd rather be in the casket than doing the eulogy. And why, you know, that's important to know is because I think you're setting yourself up for failure if you go into something like that thinking it's going to be easy. Because you brought up a good point about the going and doing a talk, you know, for $20,000. I think sometimes people hear what speaking fees happen and are possible and say, I'd like to do that, but don't recognize that there's a starting point, because it's not easy to conquer that fear. And if you set yourself up for that, you're going to hurt the client and yourself. If you just set yourself up to convince somebody that you can do a talk and you've never done a talk before. My very first talk, I don't remember exactly what I said. The people in the room told me I turned a couple of shades of green, and I got through it. It was about an hour and a half. I didn't have any structure. I didn't know the time I went. I didn't know anything. I just literally kind of went blank out. It was like I had a blackout. So that's how intense it was. But what I would recommend for people, so they don't have to go through that, so let's get onto the positive, what they don't have to do, is what I would recommend to anybody thinking about it, to go into a supportive group like a Toastmasters. And if people listening don't know what Toastmasters is, very worthwhile looking up what Toastmasters is and just going to their website and what have you. But basically, Toastmasters is a group that supports and helps people get into public speaking, whether it's just he'd be able to speak at their office, one-on-one, whatever that might be. So that's really the starting point, because Toastmasters is collaborative, it's easy, and the best part is you can go to the room and watch other people speak and never, ever have to say a word until you're comfortable to say a word. I mean, as long as you have the right support of Toastmaster Group, you can go to the room, never, ever talk, and just, you know, pretend to yourself you're going to conquer the fear. And then eventually what will happen is you'll get to see over and over again these people in the room talking in front of people, and new people come in who are terrified and end up doing it. And eventually you'll get kind of the nerve, we'll say, to do it. And you'll also see what it's all about, and you'll learn some tips before you ever have to speak publicly. So I would say a great starting point, whether it's Toastmasters or maybe taking a Dale Carnegie course, I would say to start at the ground zero and go learn before you're actually doing it for a client. And then the second step is what you highlighted there, what I said that I did, was go and actually do a talk for a group like a Rotary, where they're looking for speakers all the time, but they're not paying the speaker, and so there's not as much and many as expectations as there would be if you're getting paid to deliver your talk. So I think the two starting points, like I say, would be to go and see other people kind of breaking in, doing their icebreaker talk at a Toastmasters group, and then starting slow by approaching groups that are nonprofit, that are always looking for a speaker, happy to give somebody a first try, and that would be really the starting point. And don't try to rush it even after you do that. Like, try to get good really quick by doing a lot of talks really often.
Yeah. Do you have to, what's the whole point of becoming a speaker? Is it to sell books? Is it to get your message out? Is it to teach people something? Can you maybe go through maybe 3 to 5 things about what you would want to become a speaker for? Because some people think they're fascinating in their own right. Sometimes it doesn't turn out that way in front of a crowd.
For sure. And you know what? One of the biggest mistakes I see people make is that they get into speaking to do exactly what you said, like to sell books, or again, because they feel there's a lot of money in the speaking industry. To me, I think the number one reason to get into the speaking field is to try to help an audience that's struggling with a certain situation, to help them move from point A to point B. So, you know, if they're struggling with, let's say your specialty is customer service. If they're struggling with their customer service, then maybe it's to help them with your knowledge that you have from being in customer service. Maybe it's to help them get stronger and better with their customer experience they're delivering. Or because you have unique insight that you can deliver to them that can help impact their staff. Or maybe it's that you, like my catalyst, I didn't have any training whenever I worked for a Fortune 500 company, and I said I don't want anybody else to ever have to go through that, and especially where a small company they're working with can't afford to bring in a trainer. So I want to be able to give that to people. Another thing would be if you were downsized and you wanted to talk to both employers and employees about how to build a culture where downsizing doesn't happen as often. So you'll notice one thing I'm kind of highlighting and sticking around, Elizabeth, is the biggest reason to me to get into it is because you have a message to deliver that can actually positively impact and influence somebody else, whether it's the group or an individual. That would be the number one reason. And then secondary reasons, for me, I have to say, and you know, I would admit openly that I'm weak at this, is that I'm not a big fan of selling products from the stage. I'm a bigger fan of delivering a powerful message, transforming people's lives, and then find me and seek me out either after or on the website or what have you, and then if they decide to purchase the products, go ahead. I will say, and this is kind of maybe a tip for somebody that gets into the speaking field for a while, is I find too many speakers try to think that let's make all their money off the products, and a lot of times, you know, it's like the book industry, there definitely is money if you're a speaker and you move, you transform somebody and you're at an event with 5,000 people, but also there's times where, in my opinion, you know, there's a good reason to share that message. So maybe you go to a group and you actually do giveaways and you give away prizes and you give away books and CDs. Because to me, what the books and CDs are about is they're to reinforce what I was there to deliver, not for me to have a second product, second revenue stream. Again, I'm not saying it's right or wrong to have that approach. I think we just all have our own distinct style. So first reason for me would be to impact people's lives. And the second reason would be to provide some informational products, whether free or whether products that have a price tag on them, that serve as a reinforcement to the message you delivered in person. So those would be my two big reasons.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be a good idea to stand on stage with your book going, I'm here today to talk to you about my book, and you can buy it right here, or anything like that.
Well, you know, it's funny.
You pass $10 up toward the front. I'll hand them out from the stage. I've seen people do that.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I won't try to make enemies in the speaking industry, because I would say there's a lot of speakers that probably take that approach. And you know what? It just doesn't feel right to me, just for my own personality type. So that doesn't work for me, but I'm not saying it's a bad approach. And
it doesn't
work. You also have to talk to your client too. Like, the client bringing you in, they might want you to do that. Or the client, like, it might be, say, a real estate industry talk, and a real estate industry talk is very used to that and actually almost mad if you don't do that. So, you know, and I mean, so for me, because I'm not really strong at that, in terms of, not that I can't do it, I'm just not strong at it in terms of my philosophy, what I'll do instead is I'll just say, you know, I'm going to talk about it apart from my book here, and the organization wanted me to make them available. So, you know, if you're interested, talk to me after. But either way, let's focus on this right now. Let's go back to the talk. So I try to say it because they want me to say it, but I also try to make it even clear to the audience. I'm making it available if you want to buy it, but I'm not trying to tell you you have to.
Yeah. I noticed in the messages about you, one of the things is that you've interviewed 2,800 of the world's high achievers. That's a lot of people. I'm just thinking about that. Like, I've done like 300 and some shows over like 3 years' time, and that's a lot of people, 2,800 people, and at a high level. And not necessarily, I like what you said, not necessarily a high income level, but somebody who's impacting or influencing or changing the world. I like those three things. Can you explain how you did that and why?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you're right. It's such a staggering number, even to me, like, it still surprises me, is that we had a guy, I guess, on the show last week, and he shared that he's right now at 2,800 interviews. And I'm like, whoa, like, it's the exact same number. I mean, and give or take, I'm sure he's rounding up or down. And I know we're past 2,800 now, but that's the number I've been kind of, once we got to that number, I've been sharing that number, then I'll wait till 3,000 and share that number. But so it's a big number, because I've only actually come across another person that I come across that has reached that number of interviews would be Darren Hardy, who publishes Success Magazine. And there's a guy named Richard St. John who published the book Eight to Be Great, who's obsessed with interviewing, and he's been doing it for, I think, 12 years straight. He's up at that number. So, but I mean, you can tell when I say that, it's there's not a lot that I've run into that is that number. So it still surprises me, but I'll tell you how it was done. Is one big thing with our radio show is we bring on 7 or 8 guests on an episode. So, you know, just from that perspective, you can start adding up numbers pretty quickly and seeing how they add up quickly. But on top of that, there's also, we're probably, I want to say, maybe 150 that haven't even aired yet on the radio show, like, that are actually sitting there in the can, if you will. So there's the interviews from the radio show, which represents, you know, probably, and funny, probably the smallest number, you know, like maybe 700, 800. But then there's a book series that I had, and I put out a 5-part book series, which was called Conversations With. And it was essentially, I've jokingly said, it's almost like a chicken soup for the soul for business people only. You know, so it's profiling business leaders and sharing their stories. So there's another, hundreds of interviews there. But the biggest one was that since 2007, I've been publishing a business publication monthly for the first and a half years, I believe it was, and then it turned to quarterly just because of my own commitments and time. But, you know, you start adding the numbers quickly and seeing, you know, 40 to 50 interviews per magazine or per publication, and you can start to see, you know, when you get up to 100 issues, how the numbers add up pretty quickly. So it's really a combination of those three things that allowed that to happen. And then you mentioned a key thing as well about the super achiever, high achiever. I always point out when I'm doing a talk that when I say those things, because I worry somebody in the audience is thinking, well, I can't be that millionaire, and they think material when they start thinking success or achievement. And I try to point out to them that I'm talking to people that influence and impact lives. So as an example, the late, great Zig Ziglar, you know, he's somebody who they estimate reached 1 million people a year for the better part of a 40-year career. So, you know, even if his family, which, you know, I'm going to say they're not, we've had Tom, his son, on the show, his daughter, Julie, we've interviewed Enzig himself, and, you know, I'm going to say they're not suffering financially, but even if they, you know, even if something happened when the economy went in 2008 and they were, to me, Zig Ziglar would still be a super achiever no matter what. You know, he's passed on now, and he's still a super achiever because of how many lives he's impacted. So that has nothing to do with material wealth whatsoever. So that's why I think that's significant, you know, when I tag that term super achiever. And then to finish that in terms of how it all came together, kind of a funny side story is that whenever I was up to about 2010, I made a list of 100 people that I considered high impact to my life, so people that influenced my life in a big way, like a Zig Ziglar, like a Jack Canfield or a T. Harv Eker, or Chalene Johnson of Turbo Jam. You know, I'd done the Turbo Jam workout, so that was big to me. Tony Horton, P90X, likewise. And so I made this list of 100 people. And I had, you know, people that I surrounded myself with who had impacted lives, other speakers, people that I would say were influencers. And I, you know, I said to them, I said, you know, I showed them a list. I said, out of this 100 people, you know, how many people do you think I'll be able to reach on this list? And the highest number I was getting was 20, you know, out of the 100. And then I was getting some people that were saying 5, you know, 3, 7, 10. I can tell you within a year's time, we had striked off, you know, for lack of a better term, 93 out of the 100. And so it really, I mean, it spoke to me so, in such a big way about the law of what I call law of action versus law of attraction. But it was about reaching out, and people always ask me, how did you reach this person? How did you reach that person? And I say, you know what? I know you want the sexy answer, but the truth is it was as simple as reaching out and being creative in terms of how I reached out. But it was literally just asking and creatively reaching out, you know, reaching out to the right person, selling a lot of benefits as to why Bill should come on to my show when he's turning down 9 out of every 10 shows. You know, it was just asking the question, but creatively asking it and showing the benefits rather than the features, you know, showing here's what Jack's going to get out of it. Here's the benefit to Jack. You know, we had 3 platforms, so the newspaper, the book series, and the radio show. So for one quick interview, we can get Jack in 3 places rather than 1, as an example, rather than saying, check out our great radio show. It's on this, you know, it's on high definition. You know what I mean? Like, they don't care about that. They care about the benefit. So that's kind of I hope that answers the question, but that's the long answer is that I basically, that's how the 2800 came about, those 3 platforms, and how I did the interviews is I literally just put myself out there, asked the questions, reached the people I thought I shouldn't have been able to, and at the very least showed them the benefits of why they should consider it. And then, by the way, I should add, for anybody who wants to reach out to people, the other cool thing, which I guess I'd be remiss not to mention, is once you have reached certain people that might be well-known or high impact or what have you, once you've done that, you can actually leverage that against getting other ones. So, for example, we had Dan Sullivan on the show recently, and Dan Sullivan runs Strategic Coach. And so he coaches people like Mark Victor Hansen and Jack Canfield and Joe Polish and Darren Hardy, you know, kind of a who's who of the thought leadership world. And so how I reached Dan Sullivan was Jack said, oh, you should reach out to Dan Sullivan. He'd be a great guest. So then, of course, when you go to Dan's office and say, yeah, Jack said we should reach out to you, obviously that holds a lot more weight than Corey saying, I have a little newspaper. Were you interested in an interview? So there you go. So that's a long answer.
I like that you're an open book, too, because it really helps teach people, especially, you know, younger people or somebody who's trying to reinvent themselves or whatever, and they're just a little bit stuck, and it gives people some new ideas. And I like that you're not afraid of people mooching and copying and your ideas. I think that, you know, not that you just gave out every idea that you have, but, you know, a couple here and there really can change somebody's life. Because somebody might really be like, you know, I really want to talk to blah, 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 but I have really no idea, and this is hopeless, and so forth. And you just changed that probably for somebody listening.
Well, you know, thank you so much, Elizabeth. And I have to say, a part of that for me is that, you know, a lot of the thought leaders that came before me, a lot of the people that were mentors to me have taught me that you have to, if you want to be of value, you have to deliver tremendous value. And the only way to deliver tremendous value is to not try to put a price tag on it. And what my experience is that if you're willing to, when I say deliver tremendous value, I mean give first and give without expectation and give knowing that you could help and transform a life. And truly, if you do that, my experience is people will seek you out rather than you having to chase people down. So for me, it's really rooted in my beliefs and philosophies that, you know, I am an open book. And if somebody sits across from me and says, how would you do this? I'm more than happy to say that. And I will say that I do the same. I have people that I work with. For example, another radio show, I was talking to a guy the other day, and he said, oh, have you ever tried this? I tried this the other day, and it had really tremendous results with it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he was reaching out to me to share an idea with me that got him 100,000 new listeners in a month. You know, so,
okay.
I mean, so when I see that happening all the time, then, of course, I'd be very hypocritical to not want to give them the same way.
Yeah, I kind of have a theory that there's plenty of room for everybody.
Yeah, there's an abundance pie, and it's abundance as big as I think it's as big, you know, that abundance pie is as big as you want to make it. So you can make the biggest pie possible, meaning I feel there's lots for everybody to go around. You know, you can bake a big pie, but if you try to hoard the pie to yourself, then sure, there's not a lot to go around because you're trying to hoard that little circle of yours, not realizing that you're missing out on all the other parts that, you know, that nobody else is hoarding.
Yeah. Why do you think it's so hard, or so easy sometimes for people to understand the art of collaboration?
You know, it's funny because
I'm a collaborator.
I feel for the people that have tackled it and tried it, it's not hard. You know, not hard, and it's not hard for them to understand the value, and they want to keep using it as much as they can because they know the value. But on the flip side, I feel for somebody that hasn't done it, they totally don't get it. You know, they're totally saying, why would I, you know, want to share with somebody else that people are out there to steal my idea and make money off it and, you know, and try to find a way to capitalize on what I'm doing. So I feel it still comes back to that whole abundance mentality. So I feel it's easy for somebody that has the abundance mentality or starts to realize the benefit of sharing. It's easy for them to collaborate because, you know, the mastermind principle is so powerful and it's transferred so many lives. And the greatest thought leaders, you know, from yesteryear, you know, your Edisons, your Fords, they all had mastermind groups, meaning they all collaborated and said, how can I grow my business? Do you have any ideas? And then they would, you know, take turns helping each other. They saw the power and benefit of it. And so for them, it became easy. And not only easy, it became crucial because it was the only way they could expand upon what they were doing because, you know, that's the only way they could grow their ideas is go to somebody else's ideas and tap into somebody else. But for somebody who's never done it, it really does feel like I'm giving stuff away or what if I share something with somebody and either they steal it or they out me, you know, they share my idea and turn it into something it wasn't. So I feel it's more of a, for lack of a better way of saying it, a misunderstanding of what collaboration really is and what it can be.
Yeah, have you ever collaborated on something with someone and at the end of it, everybody's duking it out?
Yeah, I have, and I have to say, I was a president for a year of a junior achievement group, and within that group, we had a board of directors, and you know we were collaborating to try to grow junior achievement, so almost like a mastermind board of directors, and I would say every second meeting, we were duking it out over ideas, because we were passionate about what our ideas were, we were passionate about what the group should be. But, yeah, we were collaborating, but we were duking it out, I feel, in a good way. But sometimes it's probably to our detriment as well. Like, there's sometimes we would get to an impasse, and, you know, I would, of course, have to break the tie or break the discussion. But there were times when we'd get stuck in the whole idea of, you know, this idea will work. I know it will. It's worked somewhere else. But yet, at the same time, not recognizing that the somewhere else wasn't, you know, it didn't have the same culture as what we were building either. So, yeah, I've been in both scenarios. I've been in scenarios where many scenarios where the collaboration has been highly beneficial and both people walk away saying, wow, what a great experience. And I have been in the odd one where it was, you know, you get to a roadblock and it becomes, you know, almost a duking it out over two ideas over which one would be more beneficial for the organization.
Yeah, or credit, or I thought of that and it's my money, or, I mean, it's just all over the place sometimes with the things people, I see sometimes just some failed collaborations. And for just a variety of reasons, from disagreement in the idea to or money or credit or, you know, there's a lot of things people can disagree about with collaboration. But on the same token, how do you think people best collaborate together and stick together? Because you see movies made, you see radio, you know, rock groups, you see, you know, there's collaboration to be learned, especially in the arts and entertainment industry.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny when you think about, you know, one of the greatest collaborations of all time also turned into perhaps the greatest duking it out scenarios of all time, which would be good old John Lennon and Paul McCartney, you know, of the Beatles. They, you know, they collaborated on some of the greatest songs ever written are considered the best songwriting and greatest songwriting duo of all time, and yet obviously had one of the, you know, the greatest breaks of all time as well. You know, part of the question would be, why was it working so well when it did, and why did it fall apart? And so I would say, why did it work so well when it did? And I feel it's because they both believed in the exact same purpose. So they both had, you know, a mission and said, this is what we want to achieve. and they both believed in the mission, and they both, you know, they might have perceived it a little differently, but the mission was the exact same. You know, whether it was to make the greatest rock music ever written, whether it was to express themselves artistically, whether it was to reach an audience and maybe move them with the music and words, but they both believed in following the same purpose, you know, and were serving the same purpose. And I feel probably what happened at the end was that the purpose changed because they've grown, yeah. because they've become bigger than life. And, you know, not to knock her at all, I don't want any lawsuits or anything, but, you know, a lot of people add in the Yoko Ono coming into the studio and stuff like that at the end. You know, I'll not make the judgment as to whether or not that was a, you know, a deal breaker, but I do believe that they changed so much. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so I feel it was like the original purpose of this small band from Liverpool changed. And that's whenever the collaboration started working less and less because, you know, they've openly said it as in interviews about, you know, your ego changes. And so they maybe had a bigger purpose or a different purpose. Or John, you know, wanted to have peace in the world, let's say. And Paul maybe wanted to share peace through great pop music. You know, so they had, I believe their purpose changed. So I think when collaboration works is that both are on the exact same path. And I feel whenever it struggles, it's when two people are trying to take a different path. You know, it's a great example is there was a band from Atlantic Canada, you know, in Canada called Haywire, and they said when they broke up, what had happened was the lead singer wanted the band to become heavier, and they were a pop band all along, and the other three members wanted to keep writing more so pop music. He felt that pop music was kind of on its way out, which at the time it sort of was. This is when kind of grunge music started coming in, and he felt they had to transform, and they were starting to go there. And I guess the band, the other three members, didn't like perhaps the sound of the newest album that he wrote more of, and it was heavier. So there's a great example of they were on two different paths. One wanted to go heavier music, one wanted to go more pop. It's a change, whereas early on they were all in the same direction going towards pop music. So that's kind of my take on why I think collaborations work and don't work. And usually it depends on whether or not, you know, whether there's disagreements on, you know, how to get to that purpose or get to that end result. That's, like you say, the duking it out that might happen, which can be positive. But if they're on the same path and the same road, I feel the collaboration can be successful. Once they start wanting to take two different roads, that's when it falls apart.
Yeah. No, I think that's really interesting. We could go on and on about collaboration, but we could do hours of shows on collaboration. I'm fascinated by collaboration and why it works, why it doesn't, what, you know, what little nuances are there that can make it better. Or, you know, I collaborate with a lot of people on a lot of different things, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And it just is sort of what it is. But I find it kind of the same thing. If both people can kind of it's almost like a stepping back off your own ego or something for the greater good of the project. Seems sometimes like that works a little bit well, or a lot of bit well.
Absolutely. And yeah, and I would say that as far as the other one added element, which kind of relates completely to that, is it comes back down to the people involved, right? You know, it's the people in the collaboration. Because another great example, like you said, there's so many variables. Like one big variable could be just that the two people involved, like one person as an example in the collaboration, just as a weird example, could have done something to a customer and the other person finds out about it and doesn't agree with that philosophy, and that causes dissension immediately. You know, there's so many other elements,
so many
like
little
just the
things.
Two people involved. Yeah, absolutely.
And yet other people can, like, it's almost like, hey, I've been married for 16 years. It's a definite collaboration. And there's lots of gives and takes. And, you know, if you just think about marriage, what it takes to be married for 16 years, some people can't stand it after 6 months, you know, or whatever. And it's interesting to me. Collaboration is sort of fascinating.
Yeah, you know, I'll add one other thing, which is maybe kind of it's something to open up people to feel and think about, but it's obviously not something I could ever cover in a short interview. But, you know, I highly recommend for people who haven't discovered this, and for people who have, they'll know exactly what I'm talking about. But for people that haven't, look into the power of understanding personality types, you know, the four personality types that exist, and how to adjust to each, and why what makes each tick. And that's another way to, I feel, be successful in collaboration, is if you can understand why a person makes the decision they do, and have empathy for that, because, you know, you understand that I might be, as an example, talkative, super high energy, full of passion, and the person I'm working with as a collaborator could be very analytical and detailed and want all the little finer details. So they might care about features and you might care about benefits. But if you don't understand that, you know, the makeup of how that personality type works, then you're just going to take it personal. But if once you start understanding this is how that personality type works and you start adjusting to people, whether it's your clients, your collaborators, your partners, that makes all the difference in the world. So even just when we said it comes down to people, it even could be as simple as understanding how you can adjust to that person or, you know, thinking from their perspective, why would they make that decision? And maybe it's actually they're trying to protect the partnership, whereas I'm trying to grow the partnership, and both of those things can exist in a positive way.
Yeah, that's clever. Very, that's really important. Yeah, or if you're trying to, you said how to understand to work with it, or if you want to.
Yeah, well, that's another great point. I even talk, when I talk to sales professionals, I talk about the four color types, and I even say to them, like I go so far as to say, I'm going to reveal the personality types. You have to still decide if you want to work with them. Because one of the big things I hear is people say, oh, I hate working with that color type. Well, if it's your own business, then make a decision. I mean, if you hate working with that color type, and let's say they could be, you know, the worst color type to spread your message, the worst color type to share positive word of mouth, they could be the worst, you know, color type for you to work with for a lot of reasons, then you still, at the end of the day, have the decision to make. What do you want to collaborate with that person for 20 years or 5 years or a year if you dislike that personality type? You can choose to do so or not do so, but like you said, at least knowing it and understanding the power of personality types, you know, then you can at least make an educated decision. And what I'll leave a person with on that personality type thing is there's a great book, because people always ask, well, what's a resource that can start diving in? You can obviously Google it and learn a lot about personality types. But there's a great book called Personality Plus that was kind of the pioneer in the industry. And so people, you know, can probably pick that up at their local bookstore for, you know, $20 and start diving into this personality type thing. And then they can look at courses that are on or Google it and learn more and dive deeper.
Well, tell me the title again.
Personality Plus.
Personality Plus. Yeah, I've read that before. I thought that's what you said. So good. So everybody listening, grab Personality Plus. Did you write that? No, I'm just kidding.
No, not at all.
I'm so kidding.
Just for people, because this is a good question, though.
You could
have. Elizabeth, because people that are, it's a good question because people that are now looking for that book might have to look up the author. So I'm going to butcher her last name, but I think it's Florence, I want to say Littimer, I believe it's her last name.
Okay.
But if they look up Florence and Personality Plus, they'll find it.
See, that'd be funnier if it was like Florence Nightingale's Personality Plus or something.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Or if it was me under a ghost name. That would be funny, too.
Yeah,
but
exactly. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about books for a minute, because I think the other takeaway that people could get from this show is learning how to be an author. You and I have both written books and all that, but we have a lot of people who I don't know about you, but my email often has, how did you do that? How do you become an author with Hay House? Should you self-publish or publish? All those questions, once you do something, people ask, how'd you do that? And I think it's a fair question, and it's really hard to answer sometimes because it's not sometimes as simple as, well, get an agent and write the book proposal and pitch the book and pray somebody doesn't take your idea and you see it coming out next year under somebody else's name and, you know, all that stuff. Sometimes people, that's the fear part, but there's a whole positive part too. So if you live in fear, you might just stop right in your tracks. Can you explain, and that's a lot right there, but can you explain to people or start to explain to people how you became an author and what you did, kind of like what you started out with speaking?
Yeah, for sure I can. And actually, for sure. And maybe I'll pose a question to you as well and turn the interview around for one quick second, Elizabeth, that maybe they can, you know, take something from this and you can, you know, tell me if I'm right or wrong. But I would say, you know, when you approached Hay House or they approached you, I would say a big part of what probably made it appealing to them, outside of obviously with Hay House, the most important thing is that you're sharing a powerful, inspirational message and that you're sharing a message they agree with and the type they publish. I would say a big benefit as well, and something they look at highly, is you having the platform like this show. I would think that was of interest to them.
I would tell any new author today that you need to have at least some semblance of an audience of some sort that follows you if you want to even be considered for traditional publishing these days. Yeah, absolutely, 100%.
Yeah, and you know, people like to say, oh, the big bad publisher, you know, why do they care about that? They're all about money. But at the end of the day, the book industry, you know, I hate to use the word struggling because I think it's thriving in many ways. But they're in a, well, yeah. let's just say they're in a big transitional period, right? People aren't sure if it's going to be, you know, buying books on Kindle. And what's happening, too, is a lot of people are putting free books up. So then, that disrupts the market as well. So there's a lot of changes. So you can't blame a publisher for wanting to put their best foot forward, having their best chance of reaching an audience and knowing they have at least some form of a guaranteed audience when they go into it. So that's why I even asked you that question, is because a big part of it, I think, for people is to understand the power of having a platform now. So whether that platform be, and you just said, some audience, so whether it be an email list that you've been building, whether it could even be social media. You know, we're bringing a person on our show in the near future who has 120,000 Twitter followers and not famous, doesn't have a book out, doesn't have any other platform. Literally, he's not – social media, I think, on Facebook, I believe he said he only has 1,000. You know, like, so Twitter he's focused on. He's just really focused on building that. But if he goes to if he can show engagement on that Twitter and he goes to a book publisher and he wants to talk about how to build a Twitter following, he probably has a better shot than the person that's starting on Twitter saying, this is my first tweet. You know, it's only, I guess, common sense. So he built this whole following. So now he has a platform by which to go to a publisher and say, look what I have here. We see it now in social media or digital marketing, but that's always existed. I heard a great story by Harvey McKay, who wrote How to Swim with Sharks Without Getting Eaten Alive.
Sharks, yeah.
And I think his other book was, one of his other books was called Beware of the Naked Man Who Offers You a Suit or a Shirt. He was great talking about question. But he went meeting. Yeah, exactly. And he went into a publishing meeting and said, I want to publish this book. It was the Sharks one. And he said, I want to publish the book. And they said, what kind of print run are you wanting us to give you? And he was a business author, a speaker, so they at least were interested. And he said, 100,000. And they said, whoa, that's unheard of. The most we ever would give somebody is 5,000, and you're new. And he said the salesperson in the room wanted to throw him out the window off the top floor. And he said, I can't believe you had the audacity to ask this. So what Harvey did is he opened up, he had brought them with him, he opened up two briefcases. And he started pulling out cards. And he'd saved every business card he'd ever been given. His father taught him that about networking. And he had something like, I can't remember the number, but it was crazy. It was something like 10,000 cards in each briefcase. So say 20,000 cards that he brought in the room that were just like piled, and he had them all elastic together in that. And he started opening them up. He said, look, here we got the president of IBM. Maybe they'll be interested in a book or two. Oh, we got FedEx. Oh, maybe they'll want a book or two. And by the time he left that meeting, he had an agreement, verbal agreement for the 100,000 book order. And the book, I can't remember the dates. I mean, this part, I'm not sure. I know all the numbers I told you for sure are accurate until now. But I feel it was something like a month or something that they had sold 100,000 print, and the book has went on to sell millions of copies. But the message for me there, bigger than anything else, you could go to the action, the power of asking for what you want, intention, all those kind of things. But to me, the biggest lesson there was that he put a platform in front of them that they couldn't deny. You know, here's 20,000 people, and they're mostly presidents and CEOs of companies that have, some cases, 20,000 employees. You know, here's the proof of all the relationships I built that I can go to tomorrow and say I have a new book out. And so it goes back to the point, you need an audience. So, you know, the first takeaway I would say to anybody who wants to get into the book business is start building your audience now if you haven't already. Or if you have an audience, then now's the time to look at ways you can position that for your book. The second thing is I would say find an audience that, you know, make sure you're speaking to an audience that wants a book and that's not diluted in the first place.
Yeah, that's what I was going to add too, because, you know, I find with my audience, yep, they're engaged audience, but a lot of my audience isn't necessarily going to buy my book all the time. They're more interested in me as a mom of four boys, or the shoes I've got on, or what my red lipstick color is. I mean, it's different than, help me learn how to change. So I'm having to work a little, personally, just so everybody, I'm having to work pretty hard to sell books. And it's not as, and I have some things I'm going to add too, because I don't believe in like loop marketing very much. I'm not the biggest fan of like landing pages and collecting emails and things like that. And I know that sounds so odd to people who love landing pages and collecting emails and things like that, but I'm not a giant fan of it. So I'm struggling with myself a little bit there.
Yeah,
I'm very protective of my own email, and I don't want all those emails. So I think think like myself in terms of that. And so I kind of love it. It's interesting, but I cherish people who actually do engage you and do buy your book and do follow you and do genuinely support you. It's awesome when you have dedicated, engaged followers.
Well, you know, I will say this, two-part, I guess, continuation of that, Elizabeth, is A, I've been I've been hesitant for, so I'm 13 years as a speaker now, and I really haven't built my email list with landing pages, but I have to admit that I'm looking into it now because I have all this content, you know, 2,800 interviews with high achievers that I want to share with people, and I see the email newsletter and list as a way to share that. So I'm not looking at it so I can collect the email to monetize it, turn it into money. I'm looking at it because I just want to impact more people. So that's the way I finally made peace with it. But at the same time, I'm still in the early stages, so I can't, you know, promise you how that'll turn out. But that's, you know, that's one side of it. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say I've got a pretty big email list, but it's select. If you look on any of my websites, where to give me your email is like all the way at the bottom. It's not at the top. And I do that personally, intentionally, because I don't love to hound people. I feel more of like a mom who's written a book and, you know, those types of things. So I'm not as aggressive as maybe I should be. And I share that with people because it's a really big world out there, and you've got to get your aggressive genes on a little bit.
You know, there's another aspect of that too. And by the way, the way you're doing it is also, in my opinion, but, you know, not knowingly perhaps, but it's positioning as well. You know, not in a bad way. It's positioning you in the sense that people are like, wow, how can I get more of her? You know, maybe I'll look at the bottom of the website. Oh, good. Finally, I found, you know, a way to get more of her. Sometimes people will seek that out if you're not pushy and you deliver such value that they'll do whatever they can to find you and seek you out. So, you know, there's two kind of trains of thought there. And the other side, and so in other words, you know, the approach you're taking is the approach I've taken for a long time, and it's worked really well for me. I'm just sort of now trying to get my aggressive genes on as well a bit. I'm from Meat Potatoes PEI, Prince Edward Island, smallest province in Canada. You know, my grandfather was always, you know, like, never become a salesperson in your life. You know, and what's the first big career I went to? I went 10 years in corporate sales. You know, and that was the hardest thing in the world for me to do. So I totally get that for sure. I will add one other thing, which I think is very important, you know, because I think it's all about perspective, you know, is changing as well. And you said a key thing, which I think is so, you said about being open. I think that's so amazing that you shared that as well. You know, you have a book on Hay House. You have this show with this big platform and audience that's done extremely well. You know, and you're willing to share that it's been a struggle to get the book out. And I have to say, for the amount of speakers that I work with and talk to, you wouldn't be probably surprised now that you know, you're going through the same thing. How many speakers that, you know, at the highest level, you know, people that are household names that still say it's not as easy as one thinks to move a lot of books, if you will.
I'm going to add this right here because it's really important. The other thing I would tell somebody new to wanting to write a book for real, like a real traditional published, I want a contract with a publisher type of book, is to understand that once you have this beautiful baby book in your hands, and like I put mine under my pillow when I got it the first night, it went right under my pillow to make sure it was real. I get it and everything, but what comes with that too is a PR firm approach that happens to market your book. And there are PR firms that can command as much as $10,000 a month that want to market you for national placements and things like that. And so if you don't have that kind of money to spend on yourself or invest in yourself, it can be a little bit of a struggle without a big, giant PR firm behind you. But there's lots of baby PR firms, and there's lots of other ways you can do things for even, you know, $20 or $50 at a crack via social media or the internet that do sometimes even more powerful things.
For sure.
It depends on your budget for marketing, but I would just say make sure that you've got some game plan, because what a publisher does is they go, okay, yep, here's an advance for writing your book. Okay, so let's say somebody gives you $30,000 for writing your book. Well, right there, that's telling you, okay, I'm expecting you to sell, let's say, 50,000 books. You know, you've got to cover your advance. So you need a marketing plan to start with that says, how are you going to actually achieve selling 50,000 books or 100,000 books or 1,000,000 books? Who's going to help you with that? Because your social media that you have may only take you so far before you need to do something else.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I guess the other thing, too, is maybe in how, and this is, I mean, this is obviously, we're, you know, this is speaking to different people in different ways.
Yeah.
But it also depends on what your goal, well, it depends, too, on what your goal is for the book. Because that's another variable, too. Like, sometimes a person's goal is to be an author. Sometimes a person's goal is I have a powerful message and I want to move as many books as possible. Sometimes it's I want to have a legacy. You know, I mean, one of the coolest things I find is walking into a store. This sounds so strange. I walk into a store like a Value Village, you know, where people have donated the items, and you know, then they're reselling them. And I see my books on those shelves, and I'm like so excited. And I've told people that, yeah. They're like, what? You know, why would you be excited? You see a book for $3 or $2 on a Value Village shelf.
Store, yeah.
And I'm so excited because it means that's how my message is getting recycled. You know, in the sense that it went to one person. They hopefully read it, and they had it for a while because I'm seeing them now, and the books were, you know, the books I'm talking about might have been 3 years ago, and it's just now they're turning it in. So that means they're turning it in for somebody else to read, and that person's going to get it. And now all of a sudden I reached two people instead of one. The book found a new home, you know, and it might boon the book lover, yeah, because that section in Value Village is kind of for book lovers. So to me, I see that all as a positive. And at the state, like, I don't take it as, oh, they didn't enjoy my book. If they had it for 3 years, whether they sat it on their coffee table or whatever they did with it, I'm happy to get the 3 years. Some books they just get and they're gone right away. So I actually look at that like a legacy being shared, and that kind of allows the book to have life beyond me and beyond that first person. So, you know, maybe you're doing it for a legacy. You know, you want your message to get out to quite a few people. What I would say is, there's other ways to look at it once you get into the book world. I mean, Jack Canfield, who we had in the show, they've moved a few books, Chicken Soup for the Soul. I think they're at 500 million now.
Yeah.
And a message you can take from how him and Mark approached their book was, what they did was they actually said, okay, who's the market? You know, they actually, you know, niched their book. So they might say, like, Chicken Soup for the Golfer Soul. And then their goal wasn't now to get into a Chapters or an Indigo or Barnes & Noble to get in the golf section. You know, they said, why don't we go to golf pro courses? That's where the golfers are at. They're coming into the golf courses, and they're walking into the pro shops. Imagine being the only book there, because it's not a bookstore, carrying a book that's dedicated to golfers. So, you know, think about your niche market and find a way to get to them that might not be as traditional as normal. You can also now, which didn't exist before, get a couple of experts in the field that you wrote the book on and bring them on to an interview online show that you can create, you know, really in your garage around a table. I mean, Gary Vaynerchuk used to have a show, Wine Library TV. I think it was something like 80 or 90,000 people a day tuned into his show. And, you know, it was basically in his garage around a table. And he'd have one day to have his cousin on, you know, from the Yukon, and the next day to have Wayne Gretzky on, you know, and it was just that random. But the show didn't
cost. That's the way this show is.
What's that, sorry?
This is the way this show is. One day you'll have my mom on, and the next day you'll have you on. You know, it's like, all right, awesome.
Yeah, cool. And that's, you know, and that's people are looking for that now. So, I mean, you can create, there's another way. So you said about there's ways you can do it now for low cost. I mean, now you can grab a flip phone or an iPhone, film yourself walking down the street, you know, in front of a building that maybe inspired your book, and then share it with your network and get them to share it. And, you know, the power of community and collaboration now can allow you to get that message out in a way that years ago you could never do without a PR firm. And then I'll finally add in when I said it depends what your goal is. There's another aspect, too, is if you're going – you asked me for tips on the speaking field earlier. Well, maybe your goal is to become a speaker. Well, a great way to leverage your book there is maybe you look at your book as not in a bad way, make sure it's quality, but maybe it's a quality business card. You know, maybe you actually decide to give it out to clients that are thinking about hiring you, and that gives you credibility because now you're an author. Or you do the book signings and those type of things, and then you can put that in your website and leverage that to make you as the expert if you want to become a speaker. So, you know, having a book, it can add a zero to your fees. So, you know, maybe your reason is to actually grow your company, or maybe, you know, you want to write a book about a field that you're in and to grow the company, not necessarily to sell books. So I want sometimes people to think about what your goal is, because sometimes it's to, you know, promote or talk about your company, and they think, well, I have to sell a lot of books, but maybe that's not the goal. There's a company I know called Property Guys, who are kind of the disruptors in the real estate world, and they put a book out, and it was on, you know, how to buy a house and sell a house successfully. Amazing tips and insight, but their goal was actually to help brand Property Guys more than it was to sell books. So just think about what your goal is too.
So we've got 6 minutes left, and I've got a bunch more things to ask you. Would you like me to honor the time or go over? You pick.
Well, I have a meeting right
okay.
afterwards. So but we can always be a to be continued. Doesn't say we can't have a show down the road. And by the way, Elizabeth, I'd love to, I mean, this, we can talk about this offline, but I'd love to bring you on our show at some point, too, to share a lot of the great insight you've learned over the years, just as a thought. But
yeah,
I'll leave that with you.
I would appreciate awesome. Yeah, I would appreciate that. Let me ask you, let's do one more question or something that you think people would like to learn about you that we didn't cover yet. Like, I love your personal legacy statements or... Your like maybe some of your personal practices or beliefs for success?
Well, I guess belief on success is probably a good area because we ask the question a lot on the show. So I have my own perspective, and I got to see a lot of other perspectives on, you know, what success, I guess, really is and kind of sort of maybe how to get there to some degree. Here's a common thing that I've discovered, and it kind of goes against what I think most people feel success is. So we talked early on about the super achievement not being material wealth. Well, whenever I ask people about success, you know, when I ask people that maybe haven't traveled down the road and had a lot of the bruises and bumps yet, they find and feel successes about money, prestige, you know, influence in terms of, you know, people say, I know this person type thing. That, or even that they get to rub shoulders with certain people. But what's interesting is when I bring people on the show, and you can tell when it's sincere, when I ask them what success means to them, and these are people that are maybe influencing a million lives, and they've had a lot of chance to interview people about what makes them tick, the most common thing that comes back is it's never, ever about money or material wealth. And I know sometimes people, you know, might look at somebody with a net worth of $10 million and say it's easy for them to say, but I've seen it from people who, we had a billionaire on the show not that long ago who lost it all. And here's the funny thing. He was a millionaire once and broke, a billionaire once and broke, a billionaire once again, and now he's just coming back out. He's in his 60s. And I asked him, you know, he was the 25th richest man in America. And I asked, well, you get there again? He goes, I'm going to be 24th. Why would I want to be something I've already been before, Corey? But so that talks a lot about intention and his confidence. Yeah. But here's the interesting thing. He was literally, his company went bankrupt. You know, I went from 1,000 employees to zero. And I asked him about success, and guess what? It was the same to him today, being broke again, as it was when he was a billionaire. So my point is, when people say it's about money, because it's easy to say that because they have money. Well, he's broke again, and he still has the same outlook. And so what I've discovered is, it typically goes a little something like, whenever you, and Bob Dylan had a great quote that I can maybe summarize it with his quote, when you go to bed at night and you get up in the morning, and in between, you do everything you do you actually love, and you can be happy about, and you can say, I made a difference, that's success. So to me, success is about impacting others' lives, about being happy with what you're doing, being on purpose, living on purpose. To me, it's all about making a difference in the world. That's what success is. If you can say you left your mark and you made a difference to somebody, one person's life or 1,000 lives or 1,000,000 lives, then to me, you've been a success for that day, that minute, that, you know, that year or that lifetime. So that's what success is to me. And that's, I guess, it also rooted in my philosophy. So my philosophy is constantly trying to find ways to add value and improve somebody else's life or maybe impact or transform their life in a small way. To me, if I do that, you know, on a regular basis, or if I've only done that once in my life, I've been a success.
Seldom do I have a guest on where I'm writing and taking notes. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. That's humbling.
And sometimes it's often, but it just depends on the month and so forth. Usually I chat and I'm listening and so forth, but I find with you I'm writing. It's very interesting. I'll have to take a screenshot of this and text it to you. And I've got ideas for us and collaboration, and it's very funny. So anyway,
awesome. Well,
lots of fun. Yeah, lots of fun to meet you and have you with us for the hour. I appreciate your time. And all your positive energy. And before we go, I was hoping you would mention your books and where to purchase them, and then I'll include that up front in the blog that I write that follows. If you could just tell us the name of your book or books. I think there's several, because you are a best-selling author.
Well, I'd be happy to, Elizabeth. And can I, you know, take maybe 30 seconds to say one other thing, because you just mentioned something really important I think I'd like to leave people with?
Yeah, take all the time you want.
Okay. Yeah, you're thinking, it's your meeting afterwards, not mine. Don't worry about it. That's awesome. The client said to me, they said, it's okay if you're a minute or two late. I told them I was on an interview beforehand. But this is really important to me to share. And why it's significant to me today, because I'm traveling today, and I just did a talk, like I said, last night. I'm in Edmonton, Alberta, in Canada, and I lived in Edmonton for a number of years. And this is when you said about, you know, positivity. One thing I want people to take from this, too, is that I feel sometimes that you see people, and you're like, wow, they just radiate positivity. It must be easy for them, or because they're lucky they were born that way. Because you do see some people that seem to be just at 3 years old, they're positive, and they never seem to change. But it doesn't have to be that way, and that's what I want to really stress. For me, so literally I read my first book when I was 27 years of age, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. I, just a few years before that, I had generalized anxiety. I'd moved from a little town of a couple thousand people to a place with almost a million, and I developed generalized anxiety, which I fought and battled with for a couple of years. It turned into hypochondria. So for people on the show who don't know what that is, essentially anytime I read about a disease or heard about a disease, I started getting the symptoms. And so why I bring this up is because I recognized more recently, after discovering my passion 10 years ago roughly, I discovered, in reflecting back, that there's no way that I could have been that positive person with that passion at that time, because being a hypochondriac, and I don't mean this as a slight because obviously I lived with it, you can't actually be highly positive and be a hypochondriac, because being a hypochondriac means you're thinking about the what if and, oh my God, this could happen to me. So how could you be, you know, they can't coexist. You can't be super highly positive and at the same time be thinking highly negative thoughts all the time. So
right. What's
really cool about that is I discovered that it literally almost till I was late 20s, I was a very negative person. So this, you know, the positivity has only been in the last 10, 12 years. So I just want people to know that it's possible to transform that. I mean, did it take a lot of work? Yeah. It involved reading, like I said, powerful and positive books. It involved listening to radio shows like yours, going and seeing other motivational speakers. There was so much involved that it was a daily, and it is a daily thing. Inspiration is a daily thing. As the great Zig Ziglar said, you know, you don't bathe yourself one day and then expect to be clean for the rest of the year. Just like you don't expect to read one inspirational quote and expect that to carry you through the whole year. So I just want to leave people with that thought as well.
And I always say you got to get good and uncomfortable to grow. I mean, I think you really do have to kind of put yourself in fear positions in order to grow. I really truly do.
Well, you kind of took the words right out of my mouth in that sense, because I have a thing I call the comfort zone grid. And it's essentially a grid of where is your comfort zone, and I get people to draw a circle and put their name in it, and then I get them to isolate what's inside of their comfort zone today and what's outside of it. Typically, their comfort zone is really small if they haven't taken steps inside of it. And usually, the biggest them, the best them possible, you know, the best them ever, is just outside of that comfort zone. And how do you do it? You map a plan and say, well, what are the small baby steps I can take that are not daunting to grow that comfort zone slightly? And if you keep growing it slightly over time, eventually it'll grow till eventually you'll maybe do stand-up comedy like me, or you'll jump out of an airplane even if you're scared of heights. You know, those things weren't in my comfort zone when I was, you know, a little kid, but I had to grow my comfort zone to get there. So like you said, I don't think any greatness starts until you start growing that comfort zone. So I really want to share that message about the positivity versus negativity, because I don't want anybody to ever think that you can't still get there. There's not time for a do-over.
Yeah, I would agree. I think some people have to really put it into practice. For sure, gratitude and positive, and change your brain a little bit. The way the brain thinks or reacts to certain situations. I completely agree with you. So your book is
for
share...
sure. So the books. The part I didn't answer yet. Go ahead. Sorry.
It's called. Well, I think you have a lot of them, but you have an international best selling book. Share Your Message with the World, and then what other ones do you have?
Well, you know, there's one more tip.
Or should we just look at
getting it? I was going to say, if you want, Elizabeth, I'll tell people where they can get that book, the Share Your Message book. But I can tell them in 2 seconds, well, 3 or 4 seconds, what it's about, which actually is another tip for somebody wanting to break into the book business. Is it's a collaboration book with 28 other co-authors, but it was a compilation, basically, like a chicken soup for the soul. And what's really interesting is for somebody who's like, I had books before I did it, but some of the authors never had a book, wanted to put a book out, and what a great way. You know, all they had to do was commit to a chapter. And by working together as collaborators, we were able to take the book to an international bestseller status. But what's really cool is for somebody saying, how do I break into the book business? You know, there's a great way to get with a publisher and to get a book out that can reach even more people, but also allow you to get to it a lot quicker because your deadline's focused on one chapter that you make the best you ever can rather than trying to do a whole book. So that's the Share Your Message book was about 28 co-authors sharing their message with the world, literally. My chapter is on living your own bucket list, and the website for that book is livingyourownbucketlist.com. And then my other books, the easiest way to find out about them is just to go to the website you mentioned off the top, which is coreyporier.com, and it's under the product link there, or also our radio show's website where people can hear interviews, some of the people I mentioned, interviews with those guests. And see the copies of the books as well there under the product link is conversationswithpassion.com.
Perfect. All right. I so appreciate your time and your energy and your positive self. myself. Thank you very much, and now we're going to be respectful of your time and say goodbye. Thank you. Have a great have a great meeting or whatever you're doing, speaking engagement, and thank you again so very, very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you. And thank you to the listeners as well.
Have a great day.
You too.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for listening to Corey Poirier. I just want to mention again that he has a global radio show called Conversations with Passion, and it's designed to help listeners learn more about the influence of finding and discovering their passion, purpose, success, happiness, fulfillment, and more. And he has a lot of great guests there, including people like Jack Canfield, John Gray, Charlene Johnson. I mean, just so many people that he's interviewed and has touched lives with. So a great collaborator. I hope you've enjoyed our show. And I'm going to take a few weeks off. My mom's coming into town. So we do, for the most part, but Sunday night, I hope you'll join us. We're going to have a show Sunday night, November 16th at 7 p.m. Brendan Kennedy from National Scouting Report is going to be joining us to share myths and truths about college sports recruiting. So I hope you'll join us for that. The link is on besteveryou.com, and we look forward to having Brendan on the show as well. All right, take care, everybody, and have a great day. And please visit us at besteveryou.com or follow us on Twitter at besteveryou. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Best Ever You Show. Want more? Visit us at besteveryou.com. Be your best and keep it real. Confident, successful, caring, and beautiful every day with Best Ever You.